Hello, everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Lara Romans. And while I have your attention, would you please be a doll and leave us a little review on your podcast platform? It really helps other cinema fans find us. Some fun things happening at Lab 111 in Amsterdam this month. You can get your tickets to our Studio Ghibli retrospective, as well as Edward Yang's classic Yi Yi. To coincide with our current Agnes Varda program called Viva Varda, here's Elliot and Kiriko in conversation about why this French filmmaker is such a beloved icon.
How have you been, Kiriko?
So good. How have you been?
I've been good. Today we're going to be talking about one of your favorites. I believe she is sort of the reason why you fell in love with cinema.
Some may say.
We're going to find out. That is the one and only Agnes Varda. Before we dive into her work, I want to first ask you, what have you been watching recently?
Well, we went to the cinema together a little over a week ago, and we went to see also, I would say, one of the greatest documentaries that exists, which is War Photographer by Christian Frey, which is a documentary about this war photographer who goes by the name of James Nachtwey. And he's kind of like this Buddhist monk type person who just goes to, I would say, the most extreme and violent places in the world. And it tells the story of the ethics of war photography, but also on how he is able to emotionally deal with this idea of continuously trying to capture the largest amounts of pain humanly imaginable. And it was really incredible.
I think the thing that I found most surprising about the film is that how accepted he was in every sort of community he would go into. There was always a sense of trust, even when he'd be capturing people like devastated, crying, or in just abject poverty. And I think maybe similar to how we're going to speak about Agnes Varda, there was a sense of compassion or a willingness to show their humanity rather than their suffering.
Yeah, and also this talks beautifully about this idea of his position not as someone who is only capturing the pain or capturing a scenario, but also being in the scenario itself. Yeah, what about you?
I watched Belly by Hype Williams. It's also part of the Garrett Bradley program of films, the same one that War Photographer is, and it's such a fun, stylish gangster film, but with a twist. So Hype Williams, he's very sort of famous music video director, and this is the only film that he ever made as a feature film. Mm. And stylishly, it's so cool. The first 10 minutes are probably one of the coolest sequences I've seen in a while. It's all like in an infrared, but with a blue glow in a nightclub, and then how it uses lighting to capture like violence within this nightclub setting is really cool. But it's about two brothers, or they're two friends, but they're almost as brothers, that get more and more involved in the criminal world and in the drug world. And I think the thing I liked most about it is that rather than falling into the sort of the contrived ending of them both dying or sort of getting too big for their boots, it's sort of them reaching a sense of enlightenment in their own way and realizing that this game isn't for them and that there's more to life. And I think it was just a refreshing take on something we've seen so much of and sort of the same sort of cliches or pitfalls within that kind of world that, yeah, I really vibed with it.
Why is it called Belly?
I think because it comes from Belly of the Beast, maybe. That's what I was thinking about.
It was during the recording of our very first Celebrating Cinema episode. The year was 2020, 1 year after Agnes Varda had passed away at the age of 19. The theme of the episode was our favorite films, and the question that we asked each other was which director we would choose to make a film about our lives. I remember saying Agnes Varda, and I think I still stand by this. I love her films very, very much, particularly her documentaries. She treats her characters with an abnormal amount of compassion, making them come to life when being filmed by her. And I think that being filmed by Agnes Varda may be one of the greatest honors that it can happen to a human life. In a slick, smooth, and adult world, in a time that Agnes started making films, her being surrounded by many hostile and pretentious losers whose name I will not name, Varda shows us that playing in every part of your life is a secret to staying young forever. She turns her films into games, setting up rules and perimeters of her playing field. In Daguerreotype, she does it by physically limiting her playing field to 90 meters away from her house as she was staying home with her two-year-old child, showing her the life of the street that she lives in. In her first feature film, Cléo de Saint-Cassette, she limits the edges of a story by showing 2 hours of the life of one woman. In The Gleaners and I, she does it by capturing the world with a digital camcorder, allowing moments of luck and coincidence to enter in her story. It is through this form of playful confinement that we see a glimpse of her playful life, capturing people who have the same way of living that attracts her to them. In The Gleaners and I, Varda follows people who glean, meaning people who collect leftover food or objects off the floor. As children, gleaning comes to us as a natural act. We pick up dirt and candy and gross things off the floor, and we put them in our mouth almost immediately, building the strong foundation of our resistant immune system. As we grow older, adults tell us that we should keep our hands off the floor, and our natural calling for discovery on the floor and play diminishes with every time that we stop ourselves from gleaning. I vaguely remember that as a child I used to play this game, where I would see the cracks between the tiles on the floor and they would mark the places where I was or was not allowed to walk. But now, as an adult, I don't see the cracks anymore. We lose the rules of the game, and the game that used to be everywhere around us, scattered on the floor, has become invisible to us. I realized that maybe Agnes's her fantastic foolery is a result of her strong immune system, built from years of picking things off the floor and making them part of her pleasure, playing in ways that only children can. Her films have definitely inspired me to make films myself, but moreover, I think she inspires me in my day-to-day, as I try to take her childlike character as an inspiration to many moments of my life and my way of seeing the world, finding games wherever I go.
Wow.
Oh, cute.
We're obviously doing this podcast because we're screening her films, but maybe it's good to start with who is Agnes Varda, because maybe some people don't even know who she is.
Oh my God, shame.
Martin Scorsese described her as one of the gods of cinema, and I don't think he's wrong.
And he's a god himself, you know, so.
But do you know a bit about her life or?
I know that she's from Brussels.
Yeah, crazy.
That's pretty crazy.
She started out as a photographer. I think she was very clever. She went to, I think, the Sorbonne. I think that's quite a famous French university where she studied philosophy. And I think how she came into film, she claims that by the age of 25, she had only watched like 20 films or something. I think it seems quite natural how she ended up in film. And I think you speak about it in your cold open of how it's more about how she sees life and how she lives. And I think she is able to translate that into filming because, as we'll go through some of her films, she doesn't really follow the sort of structures of cinema or expectations of what we might expect a film to be. And she is much more led by curiosity.
I recently was in Paris for just one afternoon in a layover, and there was an Agnes Varda exhibition. So that's like the one thing that I went to do when I had a couple of hours there. And it was an exhibition about how she uses her house or the apartment that she lived in for, I think, over 40 years or something.
Yeah.
As a playground for many of the work that she made. And she had already lived there at a very young age. So when she had just moved to Paris, she was already living on the Rue de Daguerreotype.
Mm.
So when she was not yet making films, but only doing photography, she used her house as sort of like a studio for photography. And already there, you can see this sense that she truly doesn't need anything in order for her to create magic. So it's just this blank space
yeah.
that has natural lighting. And she has like a few attributes like this sort of papier-mâché golden wings that she has laying around there, or like a pretty chair or whatever. And she just invites her friends over to sort of take portraits of them, or I don't know, she films her cat, or like, it's just, she has this incredible talent of, in Dutch you say, turning a fly into an elephant. Meaning you really need the smallest amount possible in order to create something grand.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, she was already doing very early on.
Yeah, there is definitely that sense she can make something out of nothing. And like you said, I think it comes from her photography. I don't know. So her first film, La Pointe Courte, in 1955, how it came about. So some of her films, to start with, she would start with a photo she had taken and then turn that into a film idea and develop it. And that's also how she would think about framing films. So she would make photos that she likes, and then that would be the frame in which she would set the action, and then she would build out of that rather than sort of the other way around or being led by the story, which I think is quite a unique way of setting a film. But with La Pointe Courte, I don't know if you've seen this. No, it's I watched it yesterday. It's incredible. I think that's something we can talk about a bit later, but every one of her films feels so unique in its own way. It never feels like you're watching the same thing twice from her, which again is very, I think, hard to do.
Mm.
She's considered an auteur, and yet she doesn't necessarily have a distinctive style that you can say, oh, I'm watching an Agnès Varda film, maybe apart from like the quirky kookiness of her films sometimes.
Wouldn't that be like the nicest way to have your auteurism described, being like, yeah, that's my kookiness is what distinguishes me as someone important.
Yeah. I think her films are very much just her. It's like a reflection of who she is as a person.
Yeah.
But with La Pointe Courte, it's set in a small French fishing town, and it's supposed to follow this couple who they both live outside of the French fishing town, but the husband is originally from there, and this is their first holiday. And it's based around them having a contemplative, very civilized intellectual argument of whether they're meant to be together and whether their love has changed or aged, let's say, and them having different perspectives. And you can tell these are very much Agnes's own thoughts, perhaps, that she's wrestling with. And then it also deals with like these French fishermen trying to resist sort of the government, trying to resist the government dictating where they can fish and affecting their livelihood. So there's this play of between the city and the small community, and how you can make a nice life for yourself in these places, but then also someone coming outside and not knowing if this is everything that she wants, the wife that is there. The two things that really struck me was, no, it's very like floaty and dreamy in the way that she moves the camera and you go through these scenes, and there are moments of like very artistic abstract shots then mixed with just very like funny pieces of dialogue or very sort of genuine characters that you feel like it's almost a documentary that you're watching. And then the other part was that normally with these sort of marital relationships, you would think they are met with some kind of crisis of infidelity or something that forces them to contemplate whether they should be together or not. But this is much more of a very natural way of approaching how we think about our love for each other or within a relationship. And so it feels much more human, this idea that they can just have a very honest conversation of whether they think they're still in love with each other, and one thinking, oh, but it's natural for love to change as we grow older and stuff like this. And yeah, I was blown away when I first watched it.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So would you say that this film is already part of of like new wave?
Good question.
New wave side, because so Agnès Varda is obviously part of the new wave movement, right? So
yeah, could you briefly explain what the French new wave is?
Yeah, so it's like these French directors in the late 50s and 60s who start a new movement, and mostly filmmakers who were previously critics, who start to have this new take on what cinema can be, and they have a much more like experimental, non-linear, non-story-driven approach to film, and also apply a lot of filming and editing techniques that are very much related to, yeah, to this, to these group of men. and then, so Agnès Varda is at this time the only woman who is included within this group. So I'm curious to know, when it comes to La Pointe Courte, how would you say that this is already a New Wave film? Or is that something that you seek? Or how does it maybe distinguish itself from this movement?
That's a good question. And sort of officially, they say Le Beau Serge by Chabrol or Truffaut are considered the first French New Wave films, or the first films of that era. But chronologically, Agnès Varda, La Pointe Courte, came out in 1955, whereas Chabrol's Le Beau Serge came out in 1958.
So she's the first.
Yes, but
she's the mother. She gave birth to the New Wave.
Yeah, but the thing was, the film didn't get a commercial release until 2008, because for whatever reason, people didn't vibe with it at the time. So
bitches.
Yeah.
So. Ugh.
I can understand why people see it as the first French New Wave film, because it's much more, as you said, contemplative, a bit non-linear, but it's not as, I would say, as obvious as French New Wave as, let's say, Abou de Soufflé, where you see the jump cuts and this playing of time, but in the sense of it not necessarily following a narrative structure that we're traditionally used to of a beginning, middle, and end, but still using that as a guideline. And the fact that, like I said, it's supposed to be about this couple and the argument that they're having, but really it's more about the French village, and it's them playing off those two together rather than following just one. So it's much more spontaneous, let's say, and led by what's interesting. And then there are more, let's say, artistic or expressionistic shots within this. So I can understand where that comes from, and I think it's interesting that she is like the only female director within the French New Wave. And I find that interesting mainly because if you look at all the men that were making French New Wave films at the time, like Truffaut, Godard, Chabrol, Jacques Demy also a bit, while they don't necessarily have the same style, they all are making films in a similar way, let's say. Whereas for her, she's very much vibing, doing her own thing, led by her own intuition. I have a feeling that because they all come from Cahiers du Cinéma, this very famous film critical journal with André Bazin, who's sort of like a very iconic French film critic and writer, there's an idea that they were exchanging ideas and they were responding to what each other were making.
Right.
Whereas I think for her, she was very much in her own lane and doing what she wants. But what's funny is with the first film, La Pointe Courte, it's edited by Alain René, who's also another French New Wave director, who is famous for Hiroshima Mon Amour, which we've talked about before, and also Night and Fog, which is about the Holocaust. And he edited the film, La Pointe Courte, but he was reluctant to do so because he was very openly sort of jealous of what Agnès had made, but also because he had a very similar idea at the time. And so he was a bit reluctant to do so. Maybe the film that everybody may know her best for, and what is considered sort of like the classical French New Wave, if you can say classical, is her next film, Cléo from 5 to 7.
C'est donc si grave.
J'ai vu le cancer. Elle est perdue.
Si c'est ça, je me tuerais.
Have you seen that one?
I have.
Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Sure, yeah. So Cléo from 5 to 7 is a film that she made 7 years after. And it's a film that follows the life of this woman called Cléo. In the first scene of the film, Cléo does a tarot reading, and then she gets told by the reader that something very bad is going to happen to her life. And from that moment on, the film follows her life for the next 2 hours of her life. So we follow Cléo real time in the streets of Paris. We follow her every single footstep, every place that she enters, every thought that she has, every encounter that she has during these 2 hours. And we sort of see her life and her insecurities and her tragedy unfold in, yeah, small everyday happenings, let's say. And Cléo is a singer, I believe. Yeah. So the film deals a lot with her position as a woman whose work it is to be looked at to some extent. So there is a lot of symbolic meaning within this film that is recurring throughout the film. So there's this constant reappearing of mirrors and Cleo looking into mirrors and sort of broken mirrors, and this idea of what it means to look at oneself when life changes and how that changes the way that you look at yourself. And I think what is so exciting about this film is that it's quite conceptual. This idea that you follow someone real time, it's really like not the thing that as a film you really want an audience to experience, because you want time to sort of be forgotten, I would say, usually to enter a different time frame that is not yours while you're sitting in the cinema. But it makes it almost, it has like a documentary feel to it, because you really understand how time passes in a very day-to-day understandable way, because it's also the same way time passes in your own life. It also unfolds, I think, very intelligently this sense of glamour that I think is so romanticized in the new wave, with all these stunning, stunning French girls like, you know, Brigitte Bardot, all these girls who sort of represent like all the things that a woman can never be.
Yeah.
And Agnès Varda sort of shows this same woman, this glamour girl who everyone idolizes, who all her colleagues idolize, but shows how death is also a part of her life.
I think that's the whole point, right? That is, she's coming to terms with her own mortality throughout the film. And because, like you said, it's filmed in real time, you also get a sense of that as a viewer. But I think something I really like is, so it's supposed to subvert the male gaze of how we look at Cleo. And one of the ways it does that is just how she wanders through the city of Paris. So actually, wrote about this before and studied it, and it was about how a city is designed. We're supposed to follow signs and follow maps to go in different ways, and I think there's actually points where she looks at maps in the city, and then how it's actually designed, she'll walk in the opposite way that she's supposed to, and these subtle hints of her as a woman able to decide for herself where she wants to go and roam freely almost within this time.
That's so cool.
And I think that's also something that's reflective of the 1960s and the French New Wave in general, of this idea of reshaping how we can liberate ourselves or take control for ourselves because of that time. Again, it's very different from our first film in the sense that it's much more conceptual, I think, in the with the use of reflections, but there's also a sense that it's also free-spirited in a way, because it doesn't really feel staged so much. It really feels like you said, as a documentary, you're following her, and that these conversations are very much, I don't know, happening on a whim, and you're not really, you're just there as a viewer watching rather than seeing something, intended, let's say.
And also, like, I think that is the absurd thing about how she makes story, is that this story is about death, essentially.
Yeah.
And it's about how, you know, how you die as a human or as a woman in many ways, or how you're sort of preparing yourself for death. And still the film is like super quirky and funny and cute and like fashionable and to some extent, and like very lighthearted. And it continues to be lighthearted, I would say, from the beginning to the end.
Yeah.
But still, like, while you're feeling all this love and laughter, you also feel the darkness, which I think is, like, no one can do that.
Yeah.
Except for, you know, our queen.
Our queen. I do want to give us a quick mention to Le Bonheur, which she made in 1965. And again, this is another fiction film. It's interesting how she starts, I think, mainly in fiction and then moves more into documentary as a career progresses, and we can talk about that next. But with Le Bonheur, it takes a look at the nuclear family in suburban France, and it's Varda sort of meditating on the limits of heterosexual conjugality and sort of how whether happiness can be found in such a simple marriage, and I think the husband is having an affair, and it's them as a wife and husband talking about this, and him also dealing with the fact that whether he feels trapped within this life and these kinds of things. And again, it's very like, takes the drama out of having an affair and much more of like an honest conversation of why people do this, or what is the feelings and motivation behind something like that. You should definitely go see that, because I know you haven't watched it yet.
I will.
It seems like you've watched more of her documentaries rather than her fictions.
I have.
Is there a reason why, or just what by chance that's happened?
I think I started by watching her documentaries, and then I loved them so much that I continued on watching her documentaries. But yeah, I think what I like about her documentaries, and I think it goes for her fiction as well, but once she starts to delve more into documentary, she also puts herself in a very significant role within the film. She always uses her own reflection as a way to reflect upon the situations that she's filming or the people that she's filming, which I like a lot, because there's this kind of like boldness to her, sort of declaring her opinions on things throughout stories that she's telling, that I think is so feminist in a very fun way. It's very subtle, but I think it really gives you the feeling that she has allowed herself to give herself some agency in how she directs.
It's very clear that she owns the film, that she is the maker of it, rather than maybe when you make documentaries, the director tries to hide themselves from it to be like, oh, it's up to the audience to decide what they think and whatnot. And it's much more like, this is what I think. Do you relate to that?
Yeah. And then one other thing that I really like about her documentary films is that she has this incredible talent for making stories about the tiniest things in life that you would never write down, in the sense that there's like these moments that happen in life that, I don't know, are so irrelevant in a way that you would never like write them down in your diary or never really mention them to other people, but still they take up a very large part of who you are or how you sort of enjoy life. Yeah. And she blows them up to like something so universal. I think that's clearest in her, I would say, her most famous documentary, The Gleaners and I. She also never allows herself to be limited by anyone. So one of the earlier documentaries that she made is called Daguerreotype.
C'est daguerreotype en couleur, ces images à l'ancienne. Ce portrait collectif est presque daguerréotypé de quelques types et typesses de la rue Daguerre.
Which is a film that she made about the people who are living on the street that live where she lives. And she made this film during the time that she had just become a mother. So she had a child that was 2 years old. And of course, during this time as a mother, but also an artist, it was not something that was very commonly combined.
Yeah.
And because, of course, she knew that she had this judgment upon her as both of these things, she decided to make a film that was limited to the length of the cable that was attached to her camera from her home, which was a length of 90 meters. So through the hole where you put in your mail, she would pull out the cable, and she would lengthen it to whatever length she would limit herself to. And then within those perimeters, she would film the people that would surround her. So in that way, she would still be able to take care of her child, her baby, but also make a film. So she films the butcher, she films her neighbors, she films, I don't know, the small épicerie around the corner, the baker, and finds magic within every single one of these people's lives in a way that you realize, oh fuck, I have neighbors too, and I have no clue about who these people are, but somehow I've grown up to become a person whose curiosity has faded. Whereas with her, you see, oh, it really doesn't matter who stands in front of her. She's able to, find magic literally in every single corner. Yeah.
Or find the individuality of anything.
Yeah, yeah, the individuality.
No two things are the same.
Yeah, yeah.
We've tried speaking about what makes her style unique, and it's clear that it's sort of a mix of different things, and basically just that she is always able to find something out of nothing, or the beauty within the tiniest of things. But I think what's also clear is that what makes it hard to pinpoint exactly her style is that it's always evolving as a filmmaker. For instance, not only does she go to fiction, but she goes to documentary, but she also embraces sort of the digitization of cinema and finds that a very fun way to then re-explore or re-establish what the boundaries are for her within that. And I think that takes us to The Gleaners and I, which you can talk about because I know you're a huge fan of it. But I say this because she basically takes a camcorder and makes something out of a road trip with this camcorder, and it becomes something quite spectacular. But yet how she uses the camcorder is also very fun to see, because it's very playful. Like, and she takes the mistakes of how she doesn't know exactly, or she takes the mistakes of her being new to this device and turns it into, again, moments of magic, which, again, I'll mention in a minute, but perhaps you want to explain a bit about what The Gleaners and I are.
Yes, The Gleaners and I is a film from the year 2000, and it's a film where Agnes tries to discover the act of gleaning. And gleaning means picking something off the floor. So whether it is something that farmers do when they are reaping potatoes, or whether it is, you know, children picking up dirt off the floor, she decides to embark on a journey throughout France to find the people who glean, and who glean for a living, or who glean out of love or art. And she does this with this camcorder, as you said. And her film has a very, I would say, also camorder-esque narrative style, because there's moments within the film that she turns on her camera and she just follows wherever her eye goes, because there's this ease with having a camera in your hand that is extremely light and is almost like a third eye, and therefore it can also capture the most, simple, non-significant moments of life. And she does that very confidently. And that makes the film also a collection of just random thoughts that she has while filming, while traveling, while reflecting upon the things that she sees, that go also far beyond this idea of gleaning. But it also makes her the gleaner of a story of her journey. And she encounters all these people like randomly on the street, or she finds them really, truly anywhere. And it becomes a film about how people live their life. Yeah, I don't think I can put it clearer than that, because it's, yes, it parts from gleaning, but it's also people who are living their day, and she just follows their day, and then she ends up following another person's day.
I think what I loved about it is that she finds all these different people who glean, and they all glean for different reasons. So some do it out of necessity, some do it out of interest, some do it because they want to reduce their waste, or they find how much waste is wasted almost sinful, let's say. And others do it simply as a lifestyle choice, and have also the most incredible lives that you wouldn't expect, only to discover when you see them gleaning and starting a conversation. And I think that's what particularly blew me away, of how she found all these people. And she's very open when she speaks to them, and she's very direct, which I think is quite a quirky charm of her. Like, she will say what she thinks without worrying of the consequences. it takes her all over France almost as she goes to sort of the different to the different countryside of where people can glean fruit to grapes for wine and this kind of stuff. This film, I think, best captures who she is as a person. And I think also what you said in your cold open of how she, for you, is sort of like a blueprint of how to live life. I think from watching this film, I can exactly understand why or how that is to be, because she is so forward and like just loves life for what it is and will embrace that for the good, the bad and the ugly, and treats everybody equally. She sees everybody having their own story, and that's all worthy of being told. And she's very much followed by where the camera takes her.
This idea that gleaning gets totally sort of expanded, and we understand every aspect of it. So sort of like the economical, social aspect of it, but also like the legal aspect of what gleaning means, the philosophical ideas of what it means to pick things off the floor, the political act of gleaning, yeah, and sort of the rebellion of gleaning, the historical act of how people have gleaned throughout history. You really get an understanding of something that you've never, ever even considered to think about as something that needs to be thought of.
Yeah.
And then she manages to sort of like tell this entire story. And throughout the film, she's also like reflected upon how she's getting older. And yeah, she just like looks at her own skin and realizes that she's getting older. And she shares this with the audience, or how she's like falling in love with a clock that doesn't work. And then she spends like a whole crazy sequence on like this clock in her house. And then in the meantime, she also goes to Japan, and she just like shows us like all the things that she brought from Japan. It's so ridiculously random.
Yeah.
In a way that, but it never feels random at all.
And yet it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what I was saying about the camcorder, there's this sequence where she forgets that the camcorder is still recording, and so it's just being held by her side, and the only point of view you can see is the lens cap that has been taken off, and she puts some jazz music underneath it and just turns it into something out of nothing again, of giving it meaning without having to think of it. And I think that's also, she embraces mistakes, or she sees everything as an opportunity to make her see something in a different way that she hasn't before.
Yeah.
And then she's also playing the trick, the optical illusion trick of making trucks disappear with her hands with the camera again, which I find very funny as well. She's just very funny.
She's crazy funny.
Yeah. Okay, Kiriko. So we kind of know Agnes Varda, at least for you, as an icon. I think that's fair to say.
Mm-hmm.
If she was still with us and you had a chance to impress her, how would you give Agnes Varda a day she will never forget?
Holy smoky. How would I impress her? Honestly, I think that like she's able to create her own fun, so it doesn't really matter where you take her or what you like try to impress her with. So I think that she's really open to new media. Like, as you said, like she's not really an old person who sort of denies the time that she lives in. So I think it would be fun to go to an electrical store and just like see what kind of new cameras there is. Maybe I would like rent a drone camera and sort of like we would like fly our drones throughout the city. I think that could be a really fun one.
That could be a fun one.
I think she'd make something amazing out of it. But also that's still like creating work of her life. I think she likes good food also. Like,
yeah,
she has a lot of funny food food moments in many of her films.
Yeah.
I think she would really appreciate a good picnic.
Would it be all gleaned?
No, I don't think so. No, I think all gleaned, it doesn't, like, that would be too, like, oh, I really love your work. Look at this gleaned meal that I made for you. Like, I would just make her a nice, you know, nice sandwich. But yeah, a good picnic and some drone flying, I think would be super cool. Did you think about this? Do you have an answer to this?
No, I didn't think about this.
I think she would really appreciate clubbing also.
Yeah.
Like a night out in the club.
You know, actually, you know those cameras where you put it on your head and then you just walk around a city.
That's fun.
I think I could see me and Agnes doing that together.
Oh my God, I could totally see you guys doing that.
Okay, a more serious question.
Oh.
I would say that she probably is sort of like the iconic female filmmaker, and it's probably also quite cliche maybe for female filmmakers to say that it's their icon, but perhaps we could talk about why she is that. Like, she did pave the way for a lot of female filmmakers that came after, and I think it's worth briefly touching upon as well.
Well, I think so. The obvious reason is that a lot of her work is very clearly feminist. She very loudly sort of proclaims that she is a feminist. She makes a lot of films about women and the struggles of what it is to be a woman. But I think also, apart from what her films tell us, she, in also a lot of interviews, has said that she has a much clearer vision on how women are supposed to make films. So I remember seeing this interview with her where she says that now, in the time that she was like one of the very few women who were making films, you know, people were not really able to distinguish good film by a woman or a bad film by a woman because there were only so few films by women that immediately she would have to sort of encourage them to be in existence. Whereas she was sort of like actively paving the way for an industry where both good films by women and bad films by women will be able to exist, so we could, you know, support both, but also have sort of our preference of female filmmakers within the larger sphere of female filmmakers. Whereas still that pool is very small, of course. But I think she was already very conscious of this very early on.
Yeah.
And then I think, her own role as a woman, as a director, as a mother, as a wife of also another famous film director, of this, group of boys who are, you know, claiming to be the largest geniuses of the world and her just doing her own thing, in a very fun way, always sticks up her middle finger to the industry, which I think is one of the most charming ways to go about your activism. It's she's very conscious of this idea that she's very angry but also a loving person at the same time, and tries to be both, and never really makes a decision about what a feminist is supposed to be, or that a feminist has certain characteristics. She, I think, embraces many of her characteristics that are, that make her a woman, and allows them to coexist at the same time, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
She never denies any part of herself.
Exactly.
So she also allows her motherhood to be a very present part in her artistry. Yeah.
I think that's very nicely put. The only thing I would add is that I think at a time where there weren't many female directors, and there still aren't as many now, but you'd expect women to perhaps try and replicate or imitate male directors in the films they make, because that's kind of like the standard of what we know as good cinema.
Right.
And she very much tore up the script or the manual of doing that and said, no, I'm going to make films how I think I should make films.
Yeah.
In a very completely different way. So it's not necessarily action heavy or full of drama or whatever. It's very much how she wanted to. And I think that sort of created a way for people, and especially women, as a blueprint for how they can also make films. Like, I think if I think of Chantal Akerman, she perhaps makes films in a similar light of what she wants to make rather than what she feels like she has to make.
Absolutely.
And I would say Varda is probably one of the first female directors to do that and show other female directors how to do that and how to make a career out of that. And that's why I would say, so it's sometimes like there's this question of like, who's your Mount Rushmore of directors? So like, who are your top five? And it's not necessarily a conversation I think is worth discussing right now. But I think no matter what, I think Agnes Varda would always or should always be in that top five of directors, just because of how iconic and individualistic her style and what she's done for cinema is. Like, I don't think anybody has done what she's done since, and the legacy that she's left for all these other filmmakers to make, I think, is something that shouldn't be underestimated. I think if you look at other male directors, other people have sort of, they're either imitating people or their style has been born out of a love for other directors. And I think hers is very much from within herself.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I guess at the end of all of this, Martin Scorsese's right. Vardo is the god of cinema, or one of the gods.
God. Mount Rushmore. Vardo for Mount Rushmore.
Get your tickets to Viva Varda at lab111.nl or via the link in the show notes. And make sure to check out our interview with Sapita Farsi about her latest film, Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk, a devastating first-hand account of the current genocide in Gaza.
Stay connected with us at Celebrating Cinema and Lab by following at Lab111 on Instagram and Letterboxd. If you love what we do, support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us climb the ranks of the podcast charts. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmertzahl and artwork from Studio FFF.